Manchester's indie rock and roll station, XS Manchester. The XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson. XS Manchester.
You're right, I am Jim Salverson, but I guess the voice just told you that, and this is the XS Long Player. Well, I guess the voice just told you that as well. Anyway, this is a deep dive into a classic album, an interview with one of the people who made that classic album. And today it is the 2007 debut number one Mercury Music Prize nominated album from The View, Hats Off to the Buskers. And I'm talking to frontman Carl Faulkner. I've forgotten exactly how big this album was when it was released, and I've forgotten exactly how good it was as well. If you haven't listened to this album in a while, go back and listen to it, particularly as Carl talks about some very specific moments and specific tracks off the album. He also talks about what it was like working with Oasis producer Owen Morris, or as he calls him, Crazy Owen Morris, which resulted in some brilliant stories, but may not have helped The View's reputation as party animals. Anyway, I will let Kyle tell the story of that and the rest of the album as we go deep on The View. Hats off to the Buskers. How you doing, mate? You okay?
I'm great, man. How are you? Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm very good. First off, thank you for taking some time to talk to me about your debut album, because I was looking back at some of the interviews you did around the time of the 10th anniversary of this album, so that would have been 2017, and I sensed that sometimes those interviews were done maybe a little reluctantly. Is that the case? And if so, why? Is it just the case that with you, as is the situation with many musicians, is you kind of like looking forward at what's next rather than looking back at what you've done previously?
I don't know, but I think when at that point in the band, but that was just before we kind of took a break. Mm. But I always remember just going, at that time, we're like, oh, press, like, hate doing press. And I think also they're always talking about we're same genes and everyone, because, oh, there's the genes guy, you know what I mean? It's like, I had more songs, but it's like, you kind of, unless it's someone that's a proper fan, like, that's what they know me for. And it's kind of taken me a few years to understand it, that's the game. So now I'm like, give me to my labels or whoever, I'm like, give me as much press as you can, I won't complain about it. But back then it was always like between the band, it was like, why am I doing all the press? And it was like, because I'd done this bit of press and I'd done that. So now it's just like kind of growing up a bit. Even then, 2017, it was quite vulnerable. So even then, that I think we're always hungover, man, you know what I mean? We're just like, oh god, can't be bothered with this. But there is that kind of snarkiness in you as well, where you're like, you kind of think, just, I've been asked these questions a million times, Could you not come up with something new? You know what I mean? Like, but that's kind of what you like when you're younger, and that's part of being in a band, I suppose. Part of growing up is thinking you shouldn't be. You should just treat every interview the same and just be on your best behaviour at all times. But back then it was like, you know how to be acted the way you wanted, and you got away with it.
I'll do my best to try and ask you something at least once that you've not been asked before on today's little chat then. I mean, we will talk a little bit more broadly about the album in a bit, but you've mentioned Same Genes and it is on this album, and I feel like we should bring it up at some point, so let's get it out of the way now. How do you feel about that song? Because as you say, it is the tune off this album, off your debut, that you've become known for as a band, and quite often people who don't know the band and know the body of work and don't appreciate this album for what it is focus on that song, and it almost becomes a bit of a meme, for want of a better word. So what's your relationship like with that record now?
I was a weird one, because when we'd released Waste Low DJs, Superstar Tradesman, which were big hits at the time. I think they were top 10, or I can't even remember, but it was when people were buying singles. We thought, oh, this is quite a good level, this is great, we're getting interviews and stuff. And when we released that song, everyone knew who we were. It put me in the stratosphere all over the world. It was like America, like, we were like number one in college radio, which is a massive thing over in America. And we're like, great, we were every place. And then we were kind of known for that song, which was great at the time, but I think everyone started asking for that song, and I think every band goes through it, where everyone's like, same Jesus. And it's like, you start getting a wee bit annoyed, and even though you're grateful for it, but then I think for like 4 years we stopped playing that song, and I think just to sort of say, like, we don't need to play that, but it's just being immature, you know what I mean? If you've got a hit, you've got to play it.
Yeah, sure.
But at the time, I mean, your kids, we were like, nah, let's not play that. But I mean, I love that song. I mean, we came back when it was when we were kids. I mean, Kieran actually came in with the first line after the same. He's up for us now, and I remember thinking that is genius. And when we came into the band with the song, we got this finished song, it was like, we knew something was great, because we used to, like, if we had a new song, we used to open with it, and we're set. We used to play in Dundee, like these small pubs, and then we'd finish it again, and by the time we'd ended the set, we'd we'd do a song, we'd go, it's a hat, it's a hat. So like, but it's class, it's still great. I mean, it's totally different from the way we used to play. Now it's, we've got a different relationship now. I mean, it feels great watching everyone singing it, you know what I mean? But back then, it's just, I mean, you've got to remember, we were on tour with like Primal Screams and Libertines and all these, and you kind of had to act a wee bit cool, like, oh, we've got a big hit. And we had had a bigger hit than any of them, like, do you know what I mean? And it was like, we were like, oh, we were like, oh, we don't even want a hit, you know what I mean? I was like, come on. I mean, this is like getting us everywhere. But at the time, I remember speaking to Bobby Gillespie and we showed him the song, showed him a couple of B-sides, and he was like, oh, I think you should go for the B-side as a single. Don't release that. It's all corporate nonsense and all that. And I was like, nah, we need to release this as a single. And I think Kieran at one point was like, yeah, let's not release this as a single. I was like, definitely need to release this as a single. Then I listen to Bobby G, man. But thank God we did, yeah. I love that tune.
Testament to the song that it still gets played on the radio right the way around the world today. Going back to the album as a whole, I mean, looking back at 2007 and the album coming out, just refreshing my memory of everything that was going on around that time, I'd forgotten the level of hype that was around The View as a band even before the album came out. There was loads of radio play for the singles. The NME were all over you. Pre-release links of the album got kind of leaked online, and that created a little more buzz as well. Did you feel as a band that all that attention was adding pressure onto you, or did you just like take it in a youthful stride at that point?
It was totally like we were that busy, like touring and like getting on planes. And And even, we'd already had success, like, even getting signed to a label. It was huge for us, you know what I mean? Like, and just playing outside of Dundee was amazing. So, I think once we all went, it was all happening. I don't, like, purely James Endicott, who signed when Owen Morris were producing. I was like, do you realise, like, what's going on? And we were like, yeah, it's quick kicking off. But he was like, no, you don't understand. And I think, like, that week when we sold, it was, like, 140,000 copies in the first day or something. It was unheard of, no, for the time. It was like, everyone was just going crazy. But even then, numbers just didn't mean anything. They were like, oh, you're on the A-list. And you go, oh, that's nice. But nobody really explained to us. I mean, I think that even now, I'm just starting to understand what publishing means, you know what I mean? I'm starting to, like, care about my tax, and I've got a wee bit older, and I'm like, oh, I need to start getting my head out of the sand. But back then, we didn't, no, being arrogant, but just never knew what was going on. So I suppose we were kind of shadowed away from that.
When it's your debut album and you're getting all that success, do you just assume that's the way it is? You don't really appreciate that there's anything different that could happen because it's happening to you and it's the first time it's happened. So that's life.
Yeah, basically. Because I think it was different because we were on a major label and that for them, first the albums. And you know, like just I would just go up to the offices and just hang about and just like sort of drink beers in the office. And I think if you had to do that now, like, they'd be like, what are you doing? I think it was obviously because we were successful and they were like letting me just, and I was going out with one of the girls in the office and I was just like kind of going, kicking him back and just like wandering about. And but I think if you were to go and do that, I'd be like, who do you think you are? You know what I mean? So, but I think then we just kind of got away. We had like a nanny that would just, if we got in trouble, she'd just go and call the police. And be like, oh, it's okay. I'm their mind, nanny women. And we had like, drivers. I never knew I got on a tube when I was a kid. You know what I mean? Now I'm like, you're a tube boy. Like, I want to go back in the day when I had a lift every place and I had my own driver. It's like, I never appreciated being on a major label. Like at that time, even major labels now won't fork out what they were forking out back then. Because it's like the record sales are not in it. So that's different, you know what I mean? If you're selling that many records, you could do whatever you want.
I mean, an illustration of how meteoric it was for you, I read that until you went on this 58-date tour around the release of the album, before that point, you'd never played outside Glasgow. Is that true?
Yeah, but the furthest we'd been was Glasgow, yeah. I'd been to England, but I never played. But yeah, it was crazy, man. We just started discovering. But then it was like every 5 months after that, we were like playing the same venues. And it was like, no, just go around in circles. So we used to call it the toilet tour. Every album, you had to go and do the toilet tour first to create a buzz. And then we'd get onto the bigger venues, but it was always like, it's an old haunt. There's some venues like just no showers and just sleep on the toilet floor from just like a couple of rolls of toilet roll to pad your face from the night before. Man,
did you have any trepidations about how the album would translate outside of Scotland? Because obviously you grew up in Dundee, and when I listen to the album, it sounds like an album that was based on the people, places, experience of you and the band growing up. So was there any kind of doubt as to how that would translate at any point?
I don't know, because I think it kind of helped, because even now when I hear, I mean, my daughter comes up to me and goes like, I've had the same jeans on for 4 days now and does this mad accent. And I'm like, am I going to sing like that? And then my missus is like, you do, you're Scottish. But I didn't think I was singing Scottish. But I think that was part of the thing where people people liked it because they were like, oh, that's that Scottish guy. But it's so weird because that's me trying to not sing Scottish, you know what I mean? I'm trying to kind of Americanize it or something a wee bit, but that was just the way it came out. I thought that was more of a thing. I think if we were singing them songs and we'd be from England and we'd not talked about where we're from, it probably wouldn't have. Because the place we're from in Drybra and Dundee, but it's not like we've never really talked about like, oh, we're from Drybra. The label kind of made that a big thing, like, oh, the boys from Drybra, the four lads, like just playing football 1 minute, next minute they're number one. They made it a big thing, and then so people were coming there, and like all these like these posh people from all over, like there's Japanese people and everything coming up like just to get a picture next to this place. But I was like, that's not our thing. We didn't used to hang about there because the label cleverly like molded it like that, so people thought, oh, I want to be a scally as well, you know what I mean? I want to just not wash my jeans for 10 days. I was like, we did have a washing machine, you know what I mean? Like everyone's like, 4 days, that's nothing, I go for six. It's just competition. A song.
You mentioned Owen Morris a moment ago. He was brought in to produce the album. At that point, he'd worked with Oasis and The Verve, so a big name producer to be brought in. Was that someone the label thought would fit, or was that someone that you guys as a band really wanted to work with at the time?
We knew him. We knew of him. We'd met him at a night. We were playing with the Horrors one night in a bowling alley. And he came up and they were like, oh my God, have you met Crazy Owen Morris yet? And he came up and he was just the most outlandish man you ever met. And then I was like, oh, the guy's done Definitely Maybe. And I mean, he mixed Definitely Maybe. He never actually recorded it. So that was, I was like, but then he done What's the Story and Being Now. And I was like, we were in awe of him. So I think the label were kind of like, oh, this is going to fit perfect. And it was Carnage. But I think at that time we were so rehearsed up and we'd be playing pretty much every day at that time. We were a unit as a band. So we basically just went and recorded it live and then just overdubbed a couple of vocals. There was no harmonies on that first record, so it was pretty easy. So it was basically our introduction to proper, like, staying up for... I mean, we did used to obviously party before that, but that was... Once we got to Owen Morris territory, it was like... Because obviously we knew he was doing this with Oasis, so we wanted to, like, make sure that we were just as party animals as them. So then it was, like, become, like, a thing after that. But, I mean, you got the sound of it. And then... The second album, the label were kind of like, oh, just do what you want on this one, basically have as much time in the studio as you want. So I think like, we never started recording until like a month down the line in the studio. We're just sitting about just kind of just being nuggets and writing songs, but very slowly, and just spending all the time in the pub because the label like couldn't really say anything because you've had a number one album. So then I think it was like the most expensive record that year.
Wow.
In the whole of Europe, I'm sure. But we are sitting there going, oh, it's to be like, it's the creative process. And it's like, it's no creative process. It's just like being an absolute fud.
I was going to say, because like Owen Morris has a bit of a reputation for being a big character. You guys built a reputation around that time for enjoying a bit of the hedonistic side of rock and roll. So did that result in just chaos in the studios? And actually, did that kind of help the recording process? Because it's a record with a vibe. And I guess... part of creating that vibe or recreating that vibe in the recorded format has to be the atmosphere within the studio when you're making it.
Well, I feel like the first two albums with Owen, they were the ones where it was, I was he gonna sing? And it was like, but we were already rehearsed up, so we were able to get like smashed and just stay up all night because we're just going and do our rehearsal. But they were the only two records that were kind of like that. The other ones that were done were with youth and were quite sober. And I mean, there was stuff going on, but the one we done with Albert was quite crazy, but the first two on were just mad. It was just crazy time. I've got really fond memories of all that, what I can remember, but it was just great time. These studios where Oasis had recorded and everything, we just felt the spirit of the place, and it was just amazing. Every year it was always like trying to get to a certain place in this big barn where you could record like vocals from like making holes in the roof so we can get the light in at certain points. And he's like, what the you're recording the light? What do you mean? He's like, band. It was that kind of vibe. So. Yeah, we were recording like cow noises and stuff at one point, and there was just stuff that happened on that thing. It was like, it was mind blowing. It was just funny, I think, because if I was able to go back in time, everyone goes, I wouldn't change a thing, but I probably would. I would go back and just get the job done and save myself a couple million quid.
It did cause you some problems though, didn't it? In terms of, I mean, it sounds like the atmosphere was great and you enjoyed recording the record, but I believe you got kicked out of the first studio you recorded in and had to kind of move the rest of the production to somewhere else.
On the first album, yeah, we got kicked out because we took the Land Rover for a spin at night, one night on the valley, and we were seeing who could like do the biggest slides on it, and it rolled. There was like 10 rolls in this big Land Rover, so we had to buy the Land Rover, and then all the people that owned the place came with pitchforks and stuff, and we're like, we need to leave the property. So the light got up and was like, who stole the think somebody stole the headrest off the taxi driver. And I was like, well, surely he must have noticed. It wasn't us. But we were kind of getting the blame for everything in that town at that time. So it was like, they were like, just leave. So we left. But we got it finished. Yeah, it was good, man. I mean, we're only kids, man. We're only 18, 19 or something. So it was, I'm not saying kids go and do that, but that's what kids do.
Yeah, completely. It wasn't just studios you burnt through at that time as a band. You kind of got through a fair few managers as well. Looking back at that period, do you feel that the changing of managers, the not having maybe a senior figure to look up to, someone to guide you through the early stages, do you feel that was detrimental to you as a band?
Yeah, probably. Thing is, we probably wouldn't have listened to any of them. We had one manager that we really liked, and then he kind of had enough of it, just enough of the nonsense. And that was when we were up for Mercury's and everything was going great, and we're getting our biggest record deals, and he's keeping him in check. And he's still to this day, he helped me run the studio over in Spain.
Okay.
And I'm glad I'm back with him because he keeps me in check. So it's good to have a sort of semi-father figure back in my life. But then he was like, I'm handing it over to these other guys, and they were doing like the Coral and the Zootons and loads of people. And we were like, we've got too many acts and all this. And we were like, we felt a bit underappreciated, like, because there was too many, we were like a small fish in a big pond, whatever. And then once he left, it kind of went downhill, and then we just got like a new manager every 6 months, and it was just like, and everything just, well, it was going on. The thing is, we were constantly touring. There was never like a moment when we weren't touring. So new managers just said, oh, that's what they're good at, so just put them back on the road. And we were like, Kim, it's no good for your health touring. I mean, obviously none of them had kids at the time. Well, more of a drummer did, but I mean, there was so much more that we could have been doing rather than just touring the same songs over and over, like, and playing the same venues. I mean, I think not having management where, because you change them all the time, I think, like, then they've not got the long game plan. So because they've seen a bit of success, then I would always advise to try and find a good manager and make sure you've got a long game rather than just filling their boots for the minute, because managers just want their 20% of what's happening at that moment in time. So they're going to say, go and tour. It's all good, man. It's all good.
I want to talk about a couple of tracks off the album, if that's cool. Specific ones. I'm going to pick a couple to talk about, and then I'd like you to pick a couple as well, if that's all right. It can be highlights, lowlights, memories from the recording process, whatever you like. But first off, I want to talk about Superstar Tradesman, because I found the Enemy review of this, and the Enemy review compared it to the song Undertones' Teenage Kicks, which I think is a pretty serious comparison to make. Was it hard not to get carried away when you've got the music press comparing you and your work to songs and bands like that?
Well, we knew that had an effect on people, because I mean we were all tradesmen at the time, but I was a bricklayer, Pete was a joiner, Kieran was a civil engineer, Mo was a butcher. So when we were singing that song, and when it was written, it was like, it was come through the heart. When we were singing that, I actually felt like people, we were saying it with conviction, and I think that really connected with people. So I think the NME saw that. I mean, there was always NME kicking about. We were playing these shows, and you saw people, I mean, everyone you meet, like all other people in bands can connect with it, because the first thing your parents tell you to do is like, get a trade, that's a guaranteed thing. You'll be safe. And when you've got the rock and roll in your eyes, the last thing you want to do is get a trade. So I think especially bands and people like from the NME and that totally connected with that, because everyone feels it, you know what I mean? And it's still one of our most deep-rooted songs. It's like, people go crazy for it, man, and it feels good. And just delivering the big, crazy vocal. It's great, man.
It's kind of got this follow your dreams, inspirational thread running through it. Was that a reflection of the time, do you think? Because, I mean, you look at music now, and a lot of music now is kind of looking at feelings of isolation, feelings of loneliness. It's a direct result of the pandemic. That's kind of what people have been experiencing over the last 3 years. So that's what's coming through in music. Now, rewind to when this album's made, and the kind of world had a bit more of a, you can do what you like, you can follow your dreams attitude to it. Was that what you were tapping into?
Yeah, well, I think, well, after leaving school, and I remember specifically what happened was when it was written, we used to rehearse underneath this pub called the Bayview, where we got the name. Came up, and a guy sort of patted this guy in a vest and patted him, and he went, oh, you're going to be a superstar, are you, son? And I was like, I felt like an absolute idiot, you know what I mean? Like, and then it was like, it was written, and then we started playing it with conviction and passion, and it was like, I think, like, you need stuff to kind of spur you on, you know what I mean? But like, just I was going, yeah, I can do this, you know what I mean? It's like, just because you've probably got a good trade in that, but it was like, that's not what I want to do. So I think there is a lot of doubt in the world, you know what I mean? A lot of people are like, just play it safe. Because it's easy to play it safe, and you'll probably have a decent life. But I mean, it just depends on what you want, you know what I mean? But we definitely did not want any of that.
I was looking back at the Enemy review, like I said, for this album, and in total, they compared you to 13 other bands in the space of the review. The bands were, there's a big list of influences here, Libertines, Buzzcocks, The Lars, Stooges, Datsuns, Iggy Pop, Larrikin Love, The Holloways, Undertones, as I mentioned before, Baby Shambles, Kings of Leon, Horrors, and Chaz and Dave as well. So 13 bands you were compared to in the course of that interview, which I love.
Yeah, they're all pretty good bands, man.
Yeah, they're all good. Well, most of them. I want to talk about another track. I want to talk about Face for the Radio, which I think's one of my favourite tracks off this album, because the whole album's really frenetic and upbeat and fast. You get through 14 tracks in around 40 minutes, and then there's this lovely little stripped-back tune, which is almost a love song if it wasn't for the lyrical content. Did you feel like the album needed like a change of pace, a gear change in the middle, and to reflect a different side of the band?
Well, I'd recorded that song in the Teapot Studios when we'd done an EP, and we tried to re-record it with Owen Morris, but he was trying to like put like bass on it and all this stuff, and then eventually like James Endicott, who was doing running the label at the time, was like, why don't we just use the original recording? I was like, well, it sounds different. But I think once we put it on, it really helped. I always thought, like, if we had released that song sooner as well, it would have been sort of more of a radio song. It would have been more on the radio. But I think the kind of the fire had burnt out. I think it was our sixth or seventh single off the album, Bees were releasing it. But yeah, that came from just me sitting at the stairs one day. We used to hang about this place called the Drive of Stairs, which is these stairs that we'd hang about. And my pal was like, he says to my brother, shut it, you've got a face for the radio. And like, I was in the middle of sort of writing a song about him anyway, because he's arrogant. And like, he's my mate, but he just like comes away with some crazy ass comment. And so I ran back and I was like, and I was kind of thinking like sort of Paul Heaton, kind of, it's a bit funny, but serious.
Yeah.
And then I ran back and I wrote it in 5 minutes, because I already had all the lines that I wanted to say about him. And I came back and I played it to him, and he was like, you better not release that. You better not play that about me, he says. Cause, well, you better not tell people it's about me, because it was all these lines in it, like, they're all true. So. But yeah, I love that. And it's still, that's still one of the songs that really reflects. When we play live, every single person knows that song, and it's always a pure heart warmer. Great.
Okay, go on, you'll go. Pick me a favourite song or a favourite moment off this album that kind of takes you right back to 2007.
There's a song called Wasteland on it, and it's got a song, Typical Time, at the end, which has become like a recurring thing, like the Typical Time 1, 2, and then Hard of 3 someplace, I'm sure. But we were at a party one night, and there was this big guy that worked at the university in Dundee, and was like, you guys will never go anywhere and all this, and he said, just like a bunch of scumbags from the Wasteland. And I was like, okay, so this is the Wasteland, okay, I'm going to turn that around. And I sort of went back and wrote the song, and he was called Rick. So it was like, it was this guy, and I remember saying, he put a bet on, I'll pay you $5,000 if he's even chart the album. And he had to pay my manager $5,000, because my manager was there. He knew he had money. So he went back and got that cash. But I remember writing that song, like, thinking, well, that's from the Wasteland, but you know what I mean? We celebrated, and it's worked it. Being from there, it wasn't like a derogatory thing. It wasn't a bad thing. People actually thought it was cool to come from where we were, and it was, I felt quite proud of being from there, like, and at the time, you know, I still am, but I mean, at the time, I really felt like you kind of say this about us, and he was just like, no, he's just scumbags. Yeah, that was pretty cool. And then to start playing that around the world, and as every time I do it, I'm just imagining just sitting at them stairs, just going, down, just for all my wee pals. And it's pretty cool to see that going around the world.
Yeah, proper two fingers up as well, I guess, that moment kind of going,
yeah, man, totally.
Look what we've become. Awesome. Carl, thank you for talking to me about Hats Off to the Buskers. It's a brilliant album, and about album that until very recently, kind of for a long time, was the most recent Scottish debut number one album. It was robbed of that title by the Snuts and their debut album last year, I think it was. I'm sure you're not bothered that you lost that title at all. It just happens at some point, doesn't it? But
well, we never lost it, because we're still the first.
Oh, was it the first ever Scottish debut number one album?
Yeah, first ever Scottish debut, yeah.
I did not know that. That's incredible. I mean, being the most recent and the first, I mean, it's testament to exactly how big that album was and how brightly you shone or burned as a band at the time. It's good to hear it kind of still feels like it's in, or you've recovered your love for it, which is really nice to hear as well. What's next for the view? Because I know you're back touring recently as well. You've had some solo projects as well. Last solo album came out 2021. So is there a chance that the view will make new music again?
Yeah, we're just finished an album. It's coming out on the 18th of August. It's called Exorcism of Youth.
Well, we look forward to hearing that. But Kyle, thanks so much for your time on the Excess Long Player.
Cheers, man. Spawn.
The Excess Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson. Excess Manchester.
Awesome, that. Love chatting to Kyle about The View's debut album, Hats Off to the Buskers. And like I said in the intro to the show, it's an amazing album. It's a brilliant album. I've not listened to it all the way through in probably 15 years. So it was great to relive some of those moments and some of those tracks. If you enjoyed this, make sure you are subscribed or following this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave a review, let me know what you make of it, or even if there's any albums you'd like me to talk about or any people you'd like me to interview, then leave your comments as a review and I'll see what I can do. I'll see if I can do it for a future episode. Plus, if this is your first time visiting the Excess Long Player, your first time listening, check back in the timeline and see if I've already covered some of your favourite albums. See you next time.
The Excess Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson. Excess Manchester.